You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the first 2 years of the Obama presidency, a number of crucial and historic decisions have been made that will affect the country for years to come. Award-winning journalist Richard Wolff has been given access to day-to-day happenings in the White House and granted interviews with key staff members and even the president himself. The result is his second book on Barack Obama called Revival. It's published by Crown, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Wolff to our program today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You say that there are two camps in the Obama White House, the survivalists and the revivalists. What does each side stand for, and who in the administration best exemplifies each camp?
Well, the revivalists are a group that that really want to revive the spirit of the campaign. They came in with the sense of reform, of wanting to bring an outsider's perspective to Washington. And they feel that that has been lost along the way as they shifted from campaigning to governing. The survivalists, on the other hand, have this kind of desperate edge to them that you've got to do what it takes. You've got to make deals. You've got to grease the wheels of Washington to get where you want to go. And in the two camps, you have very different figures. It's not just a sort of Chicago, Washington thing. It's not purely campaign people or non-campaign people. There are people who cross over. But on the revival side, there are people like David Plouffe, who managed the campaign, who will shortly be going back into the White House. Anita Dunn, Dan Pfeiffer, communications people, David Axelrod. On the survivalist side, Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff. Pete Rouse, the new chief of staff. You have this confluence of people and actually a president who has his foot in both camps. And my feeling is that one of the reasons this White House has got into the mess it has is because they haven't been able to resolve these big disputes, this big question of identity between these two camps.
But it sounds to me like the revivalists are the people who set the message that got the president elected.
Right.
Whereas the survivalists are the people who used to work for Bill Clinton who are telling him we got to do things the way Bill did them.
Well, they're not purely Clinton people. Pete Rouse was actually the chief of staff for Obama in his Senate office. So it does cut across lines here, and there are some new people as well. But the campaign wasn't just a means to an end. You know, normally campaigns are the journey, and you know, you have people who want to shed everything that they've promised in the campaign. For these guys, 21 months on the campaign trail was where they forged their identity. And to get rid of it, to move away from it, they see as a sort of betrayal.
Well, you've named your book Revival. Mightn't someone else, after the recent election, have called it Survival?
There is this
or the hope to survive?
Well, there is this edge to both sides. Look, the revivalists have an idealistic tinge to them, and there's obviously a sort of religious overlay there. They're a little bit spiritual about what they went through. And the survivalists have this sort of, as I said, a desperate edge. My period that I looked at, the sort of canvas for this book, was a two-month period at the start of the year. In mid-January, this presidency was supposed to be over. Healthcare was dead. They just lost the Senate race in Massachusetts, and everything was supposed to be finished. 2 months later, the sort of end period of my timeline, healthcare is done. The biggest piece of domestic legislation in a generation or more. There is this arc of failure to success that I've seen time and again with this president, and we may be at another of those massive swings of the pendulum again right now.
Well, it was over, you said, after Scott Brown was elected. Now it's over.
It's over
after
it's all
the House was lost.
Right.
In thinking back at how he has governed over the past 2 years, do you think Barack Obama is trying to change the Washington system or simply master it?
You know, in the final stretch in Iowa, the president, then Senator Obama, gave a speech clarifying the choice between himself and Hillary Clinton. He said, "You cannot at once offer yourself as the master of a broken system in Washington and say you're the person to change it." And I think what he did in that first year especially was try to do just that. He tried to be what essentially Hillary Clinton was offering in the primaries, to do both, to say, I'm the reformer and I can pull all the levers of power. And in fact, it's a contradictory position. So he ended up doing things which undermined his campaign promises and identity, like For instance, earmarks are in the news. He signed a bill that had 9,000 earmarks in. It's tough to say you're going to change the ways of Washington and then buckle down to them because you think you're going to get other stuff for that.
But didn't Mitch McConnell do the same thing just recently?
Oh, sure. There are lots of people. But Mitch McConnell didn't come in and say, I'm the candidate of change. You know,
I'm the candidate of no.
He said, well, and he's done that supremely well. The point with this president was that he was going to do things differently. And what happened was, entering healthcare, he had done lots of backroom deals with senators, with industry, and he started to look just like another Washington politician and not like the candidate of change.
Well, you write that the president's, I'm quoting, mistake, if not his hubris, was to assume that others would either share his powers of reason or understand the sincerity of his motives. Maybe I'm being cynical, but doesn't that sound a bit naive?
I think there was a huge amount of naivety in that first year.
Well, wasn't he a senator? Didn't he know that Washington is a nest of vipers?
There is one thing to know it and another thing to think, having gone through a historic election, that people would just follow the lead. And there was a naivete about the Republicans as well, which they woke up to surprisingly late. They thought that there were reasonable Republicans that they could reach out to. And something I quote at the end is Rahm Emanuel, who frankly has never been reasonable about Republicans, saying there was no Bob Dole in this party. We tried to reach out. We tried to find the person in the center. But even Ronald Reagan couldn't win his own party's nomination today.
So do you think one side, the survivalists or the revivalists, are in the ascendant in the Obama White House after these 2010 midterms?
I think very much the revivalists have come back into force here, because
they're saying we should go back to our
saying
original
go back to the campaign, go back to the change message, because, and it's not just a message, by the way, it's an identity. That's why you're seeing the president jump on the earmarks reform that the Republicans have handed out there. But it's also a sort of campaign style. One thing they were also naive about was they thought they could shift to governing and Republicans would join them in the governing mission, save the country from an economic crisis and deal with national security, sign up to closing Guantanamo, because after all, Bush and McCain said they wanted to do that. What they didn't realize was the other side was going to continue campaigning, and that's a lesson they learned very painfully.
Well, is there a real difference between governing and campaigning in Washington today? Are we in a perpetual campaign?
I think we are in a perpetual campaign. And again, for people who had been very savvy about their own campaign, who had spent a long time doing just that, it took them a long time to wake up. Remember that it was only recently that they'd spent 21 months in the White House. So the campaign was something that was a very lived experience, very present for them. And they were slow to want to go back to those days because it had been such a long and frankly painful experience.
My guest is Richard Wolff, Wolffe. His latest book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. It is published by Crown. During the campaign, Mr. Obama vowed to pass health care reform in the first term. Once he was elected, did a lot of people in the White House agree that health care was the best way for the president to define his first year in office?
No, they didn't. In fact, Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, thought it was insane to try and do that. He did not agree that there was only one opportunity to do health care, and that was right then. By the way, a little detail that I picked up in reporting this book, the promise to put health care into the first term was made on a whim. Right at the start of the campaign, they didn't have a health care policy, and they threw it into an event because they wanted to make some news, and people thought it was insane. So it was incredibly ambitious to do it in the first term. To do it in the first year, as I said, a lot of opposition from senior staff who thought that it was reckless.
And it was really Robert Gibbs who kind of suggested it, and everybody just jumped on it?
Gibbs in the campaign suggested, let's throw this in as a first-term promise because we have no other news to make here. Hillary Clinton has got a healthcare policy and we don't, so let's try and make some news.
And she was saying we should wait a little while before we even try to change the healthcare system.
She thought it would take two terms. No other candidate in the primary would sign up to a pledge in the first term. And now, Obama's healthcare proposals were less ambitious to begin with. They ended up actually stealing just about everyone else's ideas. But in the beginning, he didn't have much to offer on it. And accelerating it in this way really forced his own White House to some sort of breaking point.
But he did have 60 votes in the Senate. And that would have suggested that this was the best opportunity. Who knew what was going to happen after the 2010 midterms?
Right. There is good reason to think if you were going to do health care, it had to be done early. They always thought they had an 18-month window or so. But how you do it? whether you do it incrementally and stop, you just get some points on the board. The message from Emmanuel was, don't fail. Whatever you do, avoid the Clinton experience. So if it means coming up short, so be it. Just get on and move on. Do the deals, do the backroom deals. Just work with Democrats if you need to, even if it's ugly.
I'd like to play a clip of the president speaking to a group of Republican lawmakers at their yearly retreat during the healthcare debate. Let's take a listen.
I am absolutely committed to working with you on these issues, but it can't just be political assertions that aren't substantiated when it comes to the actual details of policy, because otherwise we're going to be selling the American people a bill of goods. I mean, the easiest thing for me to do on the healthcare debate would have been to tell people that what you're going to get is guaranteed health insurance, lower your costs, all the insurance reforms. We're going to lower the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, and it won't cost anybody anything. That's great politics. It's just not true. So there's got to be some test of realism in any of these proposals, mine included.
But it's interesting that he started with a proposal that many considered to be industry-friendly and had been supported in the past by Bob Dole and Mitt Romney, lacked things that liberals wanted, like the public option.
This was essentially a Republican bill. I mean, that's what's ironic about him being outmaneuvered and portrayed as a big government socialist.
To control our lives. I get email from people all the time saying, we voted for this guy for change. We didn't vote for somebody to control every facet of our lives.
Right. So this is a private sector approach. I think what they did was these backroom deals with senators, with the industry, which tarnished that view of him as the outsider. It was too inside dealing. But here's the sort of irony of how this eventually got done. That House Republican retreat where he does this sort of question and answer session, like a prime minister's question time from the UK, he wanted to do that really early. He wanted to make that a standard. There were lots of speculation from people on the left saying he should do this more often. He wanted to do it right in the beginning as a sign that he was going to do different kind of politics. And as I report in Revival, he was overruled on that early on. Again, don't make any risks. Live with Washington the way it is. He missed a golden opportunity early on to signal to people that he was going to play this game differently.
He did something similar with the stimulus package, didn't he? It included a number of tax cuts that Republicans wanted.
A third of the money went to tax cuts. So, you know, this is a president who's just come out of this midterm election saying he got portrayed as a tax and spend liberal. To be a tax and spend liberal when you put a third of this giant amount of money into tax cuts is an extraordinary admission of failure. You can argue that they tried to do too much. I think they tried to be all things to all people and ended up being not much to anyone.
But didn't he also understand that no matter what he gave to the Republicans, they were going to depict him as this some guy who was putting us on the slippery slope to socialism?
Their assumption early on was that Republicans would respect the result of the election and step up to the plate and the crisis
they hadn't
the country
done that
was
with Bill Clinton.
they believed their own hype, and also I think they felt that the stories would tell themselves. People would know that he had spent this giant amount of money on the recovery. I still have Democrats coming up to me today saying that the president had done nothing on the economy. He spent as much money on the Recovery Act as President Bush did in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And yet many people, as Joe Biden told me, many people didn't know where the tax cuts came from. They thought there were pay rises they were getting from their own employers. That's how badly they explained $800 billion.
My guest is Richard Wolffe, Wolffe, who covered the entire length of Barack Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine. And now he is with MSNBC, appearing frequently on Countdown with Keith Olbermann and Hardball with Chris Matthews. He was given unprecedented access to the Obama White House, and the result is a book called Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. It is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Richard Wolff, whose follow-up to his bestseller Renegade is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House, published by Crown. Richard, I'd like to play another clip from that Republican retreat. And this one had a zinger.
Yep.
But if you were to listen to the debate, and frankly how some of you went after this bill, you'd think that this thing was some Bolshevik plot.
Well, he had that little zinger in there, and it was confrontational, also clear and funny. Some of his supporters may wonder why he doesn't say that about all the other smears that have been thrown at him, that he wasn't, there's no birth certificate, allegations that he's a Muslim. Why doesn't he just point out that those things are not true?
Well, in the campaign, they were pretty aggressive about pushing back on this sort of stuff. Often he wouldn't do it himself. They would do it through their website or through his many press people. But there comes a force of hearing it from a president whose natural default position is to say, I'm above these political games. These are gimmicks. These are falsehoods. I'm going to call you out on that. And I think that's the path forward for him. You know, one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to look at not just how they got into this mess, but how they could get out of it. And in healthcare, one of the things that pushed it over the top was him saying, listen, people, we've got to be grown up here. We're actually reducing costs here. This reduces the deficit. You say you care about the deficit. This is how we're going to do it. And that aggressive campaigning, speaking out to issues that actually – especially independent voters want to hear. It's not just Democrats. Those are the people he lost in the midterms. That's a path for him moving forward at this stage when they are yet again and facing this crisis.
Well, he thought this would be a great victory. Wasn't he punished for the health care bill in the midterms?
Well, that's curious. If you look at the polling, you know, that's a Republican line that he was punished for health care. Public opinion is really where it was a year ago. It's split 50-50. People cite the numbers wanting repeal, but as many want the legislation strengthened or left where it is. So given how poorly it's been explained, given how little is actually enacted already in terms of what this bill promises to do, 50-50 isn't a bad position to be in. The question is, what were these voters really motivated by? It may have been the base for the Republicans were motivated by being against Obama, against health care. But independents and Democrats are not along that track.
Well, there were all of those crazy things like death panels and such that were cited. But that all was connected to some degree to the Tea Party movement. How does the president view the Tea Party movement?
Well, they have been taken aback, I think, by the energy that has come into play here. But there's also a certain amount of relish at the prospects of what the Tea Party can do in terms of pulling apart the Republicans. One thing they're looking at right now is whether they can split apart congressional Republicans from the Republican presidential contenders and the Tea Party. And they're looking for those issues that will expose differences. For instance, this president has lost none of his ambition. And as I write in the book, he is looking at immigration as one of those wedge issues where Republicans in the establishment know that they really have to reach out to Latino voters, Tea Party folks. Republican presidential candidates are going to find that much, much harder to sign on to.
Well, but when the president was first elected, he said something rather insulting about Rush Limbaugh throwing down the gauntlet. And Rush Limbaugh has paid him back in kind. Some people have said that was a rather silly thing for Barack Obama to do. Does he really understand that you don't inflame the people who can hurt you most? It seems to me the same sort of thing is about to happen with the Tea Party people.
If you're just attacking one side, it is very hard, especially someone with as big a pair of lungs as Rush Limbaugh. It's very hard to say you're the bipartisan guy if you're actually just engaging in the partisan attacks. That's why, to some degree, this is a White House that quite likes the idea of Pelosi and Boehner being out there. One point I mentioned, just to come back to healthcare quickly, one ad they loved in the campaign that he revived during the closing stage of healthcare was an ad that said, there are people on the left who want more government. There are people on the right who want to leave you on your own. Barack Obama is for this position in the middle. He was a triangulator before he ever needed to be.
Well, on the other hand, we have a lot of Democrats saying that the best thing that could happen is that somebody like Sarah Palin ran for president. But then you look at what happened in Nevada and how close Sharron Angle came to being elected despite a lot of missteps, I'm not so sure that the Democrats should feel all that sanguine right now.
Well, Sarah Palin's numbers have got worse, not better, since the presidential election. It would be extremely hard for her to get general appeal, to win over those independents, to get cross-party support, which you really need in this country. So the idea of Sarah Palin being this sort of piece of political kryptonite aimed at Barack Obama doesn't stand up to where the numbers are right now.
Does Mitt Romney look like a more viable candidate now than he did in the past?
I think the economy is clearly where this administration finds it's on weakest ground, and a Republican with strong economic credentials, whether it's Mitt Romney or Mitch Daniels in Indiana, those are the kinds of people that the establishment of the party would lean towards. Now, whether the establishment can bring the Tea Party, the grassroots, along is going to be a very fascinating dynamic.
Early in his administration, especially after Hillary Clinton was brought in as Secretary of State, there was a lot of talk of a team of rivals. Do you think that's panned out?
And well, you know,
is what's happened the best?
One thing that I point out in the book is in the national security debate, Robert Gates has become much more influential. And he's a Republican appointee of Bush at defense, much more influential in getting his voice heard, the policies tweaked in his way and pushed it in his way than Secretary Clinton. And while Clinton and Obama have got a cordial relationship, a trusting relationship, as I say in Revival, the two staffs, the aides to both of these figures, Clinton and Obama, still have a lot of lingering resentment and suspicion. And it's still not good. I mean, you can see it played out today. Just the other day, a pollster connected with Mark Penn, works for Fox News, Doug Schoen, said that the president should step down after one term. You know, that's not a way that these two sides are going to build up trust. Not that Doug Schoen ever wants to do that, but it just speaks to this continuing rivalry between these two sides. And it plays out. It's not ideological. This isn't a split as you had between the doves and the hawks or the neocons and the conservatives inside the Bush White House and administration. This is about personal rivalry. It's about a style of politics. It's about reforming Washington versus being the master of the system. And the Clinton folks have not put down their tools.
Do you think things will change after Secretary Gates leaves the administration?
In terms of defense policy, I think you're going to see a more rapid movement towards wrapping up Afghanistan. I do think there is a commitment, as Vice President Biden told me, there's a real commitment to saying to the military, you have not delivered. We've given you the time. The summer of next year is the time to begin the withdrawal, not to end the withdrawal, but to begin it. And there's a shift that will take place then. But, you know, there are a number of Republicans like Lindsey Graham who also said if General Petraeus, the guy who took over from General McChrystal after that whole Rolling Stone article, if General Petraeus cannot make this work, then nobody can. And there is Republican support for that as well as Democrats, obviously.
Well, the president ran on a campaign that promised that we would go into Afghanistan, shift our focus from Iraq to Afghanistan. Well, Afghanistan has been a disaster for him. And I wonder how much this is of his own making or whether he was boxed in by generals at the Pentagon who demanded more troops in Afghanistan.
Well, I think it may be too early to say it's a disaster. It's an unresolved, painful and painfully slow strategy, which really hasn't progressed as the generals promised it. And one thing I report in Revival is how the president was deeply, deeply skeptical. He said to them repeatedly, in the formulation that actually was an extension of Bush's strategy, do not clear and hold what you cannot build and transfer. And so they would come back to him in this period. They just started this offensive around the area of Marja, and now they're over in Kandahar. And they'd say, we've cleared and we're holding this position. And he'd say, yeah, but you're not building and you're not transferring. Transferring of power was the key part of this. That's the strategy, the goal. And as Joe Biden told me, they promised a government in a box, but they never saw the box. There was never any rollout of these Afghan officials that the general said they had ready to roll out.
Didn't the president write a long memo detailing what he wanted out of the Afghan campaign?
He did, but that's a great revelation from Bob Woodward. The thing is, it's about follow through. This is what this president, I think, has learned from his predecessor. If you're not managing the generals. If you just give them more time, the generals will always want more time and more bodies. Because with enough time and enough troops, you can do anything. The challenge for the president, and he said this as a candidate. I saw him interact with General Petraeus. Petraeus said, you know, you've got to stick with Iraq. And candidate Obama said, well, as president, I have other issues I've got to balance. National security, the financial cost, having an open-ended commitment to Iraq doesn't make any sense. And that is his approach to Afghanistan as well.
Richard Wolff is my guest. His latest book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. It's published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The president has also been unable to change two issues that he campaigned on, closing Guantanamo Bay and repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And both of those have been held up in Congress. But on things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the president's Justice Department is defending the law in court.
Right. And I think
surprising a lot of people.
Yeah, they say they want to do it the right way, but which means you have to change the legislation. I think there is – people are right to pick up on the sort of foot-dragging approach here. And you have to come back to the fact that this was a candidate who said he did not support gay marriage. He has not, in spite of his professed alignment with the community, he has not actually been a leader on these issues. There is a – and this links into Guantanamo. There is a burden he felt in going into government, whether it comes to the troops or it's about the CIA, where he does not want to make these people an enemy. It's not just about learning the lessons of Clinton. And that has meant a lot of hedging and compromises on campaign promises. So he said he wanted to close Guantanamo. He made some efforts to that. He declassified the torture memos, but there came a point where the agency said, if you carry on doing this, you're going to threaten operations. And he's faced similar issues from the military. You've got to do this in the right way. You mustn't be too disruptive. You're fighting two wars. And as I point out in Revival, there are a number of times his aides told me, well, he's had to balance being commander-in-chief with what he wants to do, with what he promised to do. That's a hedge. That's him reversing himself.
During the election, we were told that if the world voted, Barack Obama would have won in a landslide. And when he took office, he promised a new era of engagement with the world. But on a number of fronts, he's failed to get things done. The summit on climate change in Copenhagen collapsed. His most recent trip to Asia has been panned as a bust. He was unable to get a free trade agreement with South Korea. In fact, he doesn't seem to be doing all that well on the diplomatic level. He has pretty much failed in attempts to get Israel and the Palestinians together for any real peace talks.
That's a harsh judgment. I think, you know, when you look at where America was in the world and standing in the world under President Bush, there has been a transformation. Now, has it gone as far as people thought? Absolutely not. Has it gone as far as they thought, as the president thought it would go?
They thought this whole thing was going to be a snap?
They thought things would move rather quicker, especially, for instance, in getting other countries to take Guantanamo detainees. It turns out that that was actually always going to be very difficult, and places like Yemen were not actually the best places to send Guantanamo detainees to. Climate change, though, the president didn't make it a domestic priority. The rest of the world was waiting to see the United States change its path. I still think there's going to be a lot of change in terms of what he can do with regulations. We're seeing different fuel emissions regulations come in, but it's very incremental. This is not going to be a big bang approach. So on the Middle East, well, it's still just about alive. Let's as George Mitchell says, you know, about Northern Ireland, there were thousands of no's before the final yes came through.
Two of the president's major policy proposals on the economy, Wall Street reform to the stimulus package, are not seen as accomplishments. Why is that? The word, in fact, economic stimulus were avoided in the midterms like the plague.
Well, stimulus had never been a great phrase. It wasn't a great phrase for Clinton either. It's kind of surprising. This gets you into the sort of communications issue. Surprising that they've never really found a story to tell about this. And again, look, Biden is the guy who's tasked with selling this stuff. And I said to him, well, why don't you do a Hoover Dam? You know, I mean, everyone's – you have a big visual thing that people can identify. And he used language we probably couldn't repeat on air, but it's in the book anyway. In his exasperation about this Hoover Dam idea, how long did it take? It took several years. You don't have several years. You've got to move quickly. They needed to do lots of things across the board. What they had to do was avoid fraud and waste and stupidity. Bike paths, skateboard parks, they said no to. And in fact, in spite of Republican efforts, there have been very few of those kinds of bad stories out there. But the problem for them is that they got measured on the Republican scale, which was you promised that unemployment wouldn't go above 8%. Those forecasts were horribly wrong. They were horribly wrong because at the time they faced all sorts of political pressures. They didn't know where the economy was really at in the transition. Still, the failure has been to tell the story of how they spent $800 billion.
Some people on the left of the Democratic Party say that the problem was on who the president appointed for his economic team.
Right.
Mostly Clintonites, Lawrence Summers, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Why were so many old Clinton hands brought into this administration? I mean, others have said, well, why didn't you bring in Krugman or Stiglitz or any number of other people who, both Nobel Prize winners who had some fresh ideas?
Right. Well, Larry Summers is no slouch on intellect, but he's
He got a lot of trouble making fun of women.
A notoriously bad manager, and that has been a root cause of much of the dysfunction inside that economic team. You know, one of the White House advisors to Obama said to me recently, we couldn't sell a message on the economy because the economic team couldn't decide what the economic policy was. Summers has been a deep skeptic of a number of different initiatives that were important to the president. On small businesses, on job creation. And you ask the basic question, why did he bring the Clinton people in? This was their transition. They thought they were moving from campaigning to governing. And they needed to be their masters of the system. They needed to reassure markets. They actually wanted Larry Summers to be Treasury Secretary. And again, one of the scoops in my book is Tim Geithner threatened to stay at the New York Fed. If he didn't get the job he wanted, he was going to play hardball and stay where he was. And that's what bounced Larry Summers into the White House. It was not a great fit. He has not been, according to several people in the economic team, an honest broker.
Early in his presidency, Barack Obama told you he still relied on the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. What were those words?
I think that comes down to self-reliance, to be honest. He didn't say specifically, and he draws on a lot of Lincoln writings. I think he draws on a lot of JFK. He told me he keeps personal diaries, which was a revelation. And I think we kind of suspected he was doing some writing. But some of those quotes don't turn out always to be true. I tell the story of how he roused the troops, the House Democrats, with a Lincoln quote. It turned out to be Reagan's version of Lincoln. It was not actually a Lincoln quote at all. A slight irony there. But Emerson, I think it comes down to self-reliance.
You write of the president's Nobel Prize acceptance speech that it was his best effort to reconcile hope and reality, principle and power, desire for change, and the demands of a commander-in-chief. But only time will tell if rhetorical reconciliation will result in policy reconciliation.
Yeah, this is not a predictive book. I mean, this is a story of someone who came to Washington promising change and ultimately got changed by it. Whether he can revert back is his big challenge. Can he actually speak to the core message, the core values that got him attention in 2004? It sounds naive about uniting red and blue America, but when his aides asked people whether they thought that message worked, whether they liked it, people were hungry for it in 2008. It was the candidate then and now the president who said, they've heard it already. They know what that's about. I think actually he kind of assumes too much. He assumes that people know what he stands for, what he said before. If he doesn't tell that story, if he doesn't tell that message, if he doesn't revive himself and his campaign identity, the other side certainly isn't going to do it for him.
Richard Wolff's follow-up to his bestseller Renegade is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. It's published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. It's been a pleasure.